The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting not from our studios in New York City, as I'm on the road filming and quite a ways away from New York, but I'm hopeful you'll all be able to hear the connection. I'm going to be having back, as promised, from earlier in the week, Rodney Smith. He's a teacher, author of what is called Vipassana, or Insight Meditation, and the founder of the Seattle Insight Meditation Society. He was a former Buddhist monk for 8 years, having lived in monastic settings in Burma and Thailand with several of the most renowned meditation teachers. And starting in the mid-1980s, Rodney has been devoted to teaching Buddhist philosophy and practice and has been a pioneer in the work with Dying in Hospice, the movement. He's also the author of several important books, including Lessons from the Dying and most recently Stepping Out of Self-Deception. As I only had a chance to give him a brief introduction, we wanted to do a great deal more today. Now, following this will be a conversation. Let me just tell you, this conversation will be with the what many consider one of the most brilliant Buddhist thinkers on the planet, Rinpoche, who is the prime minister in exile of the Tibetan people and probably second to the Dalai Lama. But that interview is coming from the foothills of the Himalayas. The technical quality will be poor. His dialogue is not the easiest to understand. I will repeat what he says about every 5 or 10 minutes. I don't want to interrupt him. But you must be very patient and listen carefully to get the full impact of what he's saying. But I still think it's worth doing, even though it won't be good technical broadcasting. Time preventing today, I will also do a commentary on Spinning the U.S. Failure in Iraq, an op-ed news by Robert Perry, and It's the Beginning of the End of the American Empire by Chalmers Johnson from TomDispatch.com. And Revolution Within the Counter-Military Industrial Complex by Diana Lee, and Violence Breeds Violence. The only thing drug gangs fear is legalization of drugs by the Independent. So needless to say, we will not be able to get to everything, but we have a lot to get to. Let's begin with my guest. Welcome back, Rodney Smith.
Thank you.
Rodney, I want to look at this from a more philosophical point of view. All right?
Mm-hmm.
I believe most spirituality in the United States and Europe today is little more than another form of self-deception due to the almost Ayn Rand-like emphasis on ourselves at the exclusion of others and the deeper qualities and virtues that break down the barriers between us and them. Now we have this new film starring Julie Roberts, Eat, Pray, Love, which is a woman's personal journey through three countries, Italy, India, and Indonesia. Three I's, or I, me, myself. How do you see popular spirituality today as simply another mode or expression of self-deception, and what do you perceive as fundamentally lacking in the popular spiritualities that focus upon self-cherishing of the individual, even if it is framed in terms of such as awakened or realized?
Well, your questions are always demanding. Let me begin by just saying I agree with you. Much of spirituality as we know it to be is a little more than self-modification. It's really trying to modify or you might say smooth off some of the rough edges of self and make ourselves a little more comfortable in the world. Even in Buddhism, which in its heart of hearts, the message is selflessness, seems to be encultured within the psychological framework in which we are modifying or trying to adapt the sense of self rather than really seeing what it is and perceiving what it is in truth. And in truth, when we the willingness to look further than just the superficial takes us into a deep mystery of ourself. And I think for most of us, we're afraid of that mystery. We prefer the image of who I am and to work from that sense of image and being fully intact, trying to make ourselves change, just doesn't work. We have to actually be willing to look at the premise, the conclusion we've drawn about ourselves, to really change the sense of self in its fundamental essence.
I appreciate that answer. Thank you. Right now, I believe we're witnessing repeatedly policies, legislation, and economic and health reform and foreign policies that are failing and are only serving to bolster certain belief systems and ideologies. And yet, the proponents of these reforms and policies are adamant of these ideologies' worth and value and importance. Is this not a form of self-deception? And doesn't the role of our fundamental intentions behind our acts ultimately produce the conditions that will lead either beneficial or undesirable end results?
Yes. I mean, we're at a point of crisis, I think, that almost everyone would agree. I think most of us would dispute on how to get over this crisis, but all of us would see ourselves in a crisis of the times. I think if you look at our just the demographics of our species now, we've spread across the planet. There are 7 billion of us. We have nowhere else to go or to hide from one another. We are no longer the small tribes we were historically, and we start interfering with each other in multiple ways. And with that and the diminishing resources available and the impact we've had on the climate, I think there's a crisis of our species that up until this point we've never fully acknowledged because it hasn't reached the pinnacle that it is now. And I think what it's requiring from us is a paradigm shift, not just an adaptation within the same paradigm. I don't think we can create the solutions necessary for us to survive as a species even more than a few more hundred years within the same way that we think and perceive ourselves. That's one of the reasons I wrote this book, because within the same way that we perceive ourselves as an individual form, as an individual sense of self, it's like 7 billion billiard balls on a single billiard table where when they start moving, they're going to clunk into each other. There's just no way to redistribute that. But when you start looking at what we truly are, and I'm not asking for a belief, I'm not asking for a belief system here. I'm asking for us to look at reality and to see whether reality holds the paradigm we're in, whether it supports the paradigm we're in. If it doesn't, then let's move to the paradigm that it does support. And when you start looking, in truth, realizing introspectively what this thing called self is, it takes us more into a mystery. It takes us into a sense of oneness, of unity, in a way that the current paradigm never will. So you have to ask yourself, well, what's happened here? Why is it that when we look out of our eyes, we see objects and a subject that's seeing? That's the paradigm that we live with. That's the paradigm that we've acted from. And that's the way that we have reasoned about life. If you look historically at how that occurred, you would come upon the fact that as a species, we had to adapt to be able to perceive life as an abstraction. We had to be able to see not just what was coming at us, but be able to see possibilities of what was coming at us and ways to escape what was coming at us, and to look at an object and to see the potential of an object rather than just what an object was. So that when we saw, as I mentioned yesterday, a stick, we could also see it as a spear. We could see it as something that would allow us to survive as a species. So we got caught in this abstract quality of the mind, and from that we started noting everything in an abstract way. When you have an a world that is more than what it really is because of the mind making it more than what it is, then you have a sense of me coming into being that has the memory of all the different ways I've used that tool, that stick, and then we have this sense of subject and object which forms in relationship to that. Now that is actually the truth of science, because science can't find a sense of me. And so that for us to act as if there was a sense of me was then that's a self-deception. And whether we can come back to the truth of the underlying reality of union would cause and allow us to change paradigms completely, so that we could step out of this this isolation that each of us feel in relationship to one another.
Mm. That's a very profound statement, and I thank you for making that. I'm going to ask you to connect a lot of dots for us based upon real, everyday situations, so we take it from the existential and philosophical and spiritual to the pragmatic and practical, okay?
Sure, please.
Especially in a society where at every level of that society, we are virtually addicted to gratifying ourselves.
Yes.
Solely. And hence giving rise to this duality of truth is out there, but my personal needs create a delusional truth in here.
Right.
Now let me just give you some examples from today's news, all right? First, and this is from the Interpress Service, climate-related security predictions coming true in Pakistan. And it says the following. Analysts have been warning for several years that the impacts of climate change directly relate to the national security of the United States and other countries, but the link has never been so clear as it is today in northern Pakistan. Flood victims queue to receive food rations at a distribution center in Pakistan's district of Punjab province. Analysts have been warning for several years that the impacts of climate change directly relate to the national security, but the link has not been paid attention to. The security implications of climate change first got official U.S. government attention this February, but nothing's been done. Now, we're looking at seas rising, water shortages, melting of the Arctic ice, extreme weather conditions everywhere, and this is causing poor people whose interests have not been addressed to have to say, okay, if I wake up today and I have no water, except the floods around me, which will kill me if I drink it with typhus and cholera, and if I have no food and there's no way of getting easily food to me, and by the time food comes, my family and myself may be dead, then that forces people, possibly for the only time, to actually push against official policy just to survive. At the same time, we see governments in the United States not saying a word about people in California moving into the forest that's going to be dry as a bone, or at a cliff that is going to erode, or right down by the ocean that's going to be washed out, and building something as if the interest of the individual always exceeds the pragmatic and practical approaches to life of cause and effect. And then my suggestion was, why don't we just, instead of giving any money to the military in Israel, shouldn't give them a nickel, but we shouldn't give a nickel to Egypt, and shouldn't give a nickel to Saudi Arabia, and shouldn't give a nickel to Pakistan. By the way, we've given $11 billion to Pakistan. Why not simply do something that's actually pragmatic and spiritual? Why not build relief shelters large enough to accommodate everyone within a given district that would have its own generators, food, seeds, water purification, so that it would be a place to go to, and then do the same thing around the United States instead of putting it in one direction. Now, I use this only as one example that if we had people in positions of power who actually cared about something other than being elected or keeping their job or just doing bureaucratic, mind-numbingly stupid work, they would actually make it a better world. But the world we live in, the body politic, and the people who are ahead of it at all levels are so dismissive of working at a spiritual solution to anything as well as a practical solution, that all the easy, obvious answers are simply avoided. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I mean, you're hitting the crux of what separation looks like when the image of ourselves is more important than the unity which underlies that image. And I think, I mean, if you just look, you stated it very well, Gary, and that is the way our paradigm has shaped itself from the self-centered concerns that each of us hold. And as long as we hold those self-centered concerns, as long as the image of who we are, the sense of me, is the predominant spokes thing of our generation, then the world is just going to look more and more in that direction. Because what you're implying as the solution is a form of unification. It's looking beyond our immediate needs, beyond the needs of the sense of our own selfish self-centeredness. And I don't think the species is capable of doing that unless there is a shift in the way we perceive. And for some of us, and it sounds like you're one of those, we have started to release the strong self-centeredness within us. We've started to become less protracted, less constricted in ourselves. And when we can feel the pain of those who are suffering in Pakistan and all across the world, and our hearts can actually touch that pain empathetically, we are actually stepping out of that deception of self. The deception of self in its hardened form is calcified in denial. It refuses to acknowledge what is in front of its eyes. I have a very good friend who is an airline pilot, and he tells me that climate change to him is fictitious. And I said, okay, well, if it's fictitious, then what you're doing is you're taking your children and you're placing them on a roulette table in Las Vegas, and you're betting your children's lives on this sense of denial you have in terms of what you're seeing in terms of the environment. And the wheel is going around, and if it hits black, your children are dead and your grandchildren are dead and your whole lineage is dead. I would prefer to take a responsive action based upon the sense that this is true and backed by the scientific evidence that it is so. Stop denying this fact and let's move in accordance with the truth of this. But that takes the willingness to step out of denial, and denial is the showcase of the sense of self. In fact, one could say that to move from unconsciousness to consciousness is the journey of the spiritual journey in totality.
One last issue on this. We also are in denial of the power of the individual and the power of individuals coming together to share a common vision in a constructive way that cares for all individuals equally. And that simply doesn't exist in our society. Instead, I'll give you a real quick one from Jill Richardson from the Speakeasy, and it's Bill Gates Foundation puts its money where its mouth is. Quote, this is short but important. Well, it's about time. Kind of like Fox News gave $1 million in campaign contributions to Republicans. It wasn't exactly a secret before, but now it's official. The Gates Foundation just bought a whopping 500,000 shares of Monsanto stock. Now, there's nothing wrong with buying Monsanto stock, but this is one more step in a long line of actions by the Gates Foundation in which it is advocating policies and agricultural technologies that will directly benefit and profit Monsanto while screwing over the most vulnerable people on earth, hungry subsistence farmers in developing countries. I wrote a piece recently about what happens when American industrial agriculture collides with poor, uneducated subsistence farmers in the developing world, and it isn't pretty. In fact, it's tragic. It's criminal. For a corporation to prey upon such a vulnerable population for its own gain, when the result is the starvation, continued impoverishment, or loss of land and lifestyle of the poor. Perhaps Gates thinks he's doing something good for the world with his advocacy of biotechnology and industrial agriculture. No doubt all of the executives from Monsanto and the other biotech companies combined tell him that every day. He should instead listen to the 400 scientists who spent 3 years performing the most comprehensive study of agricultural knowledge, science, and technology in the history of the world, the IAASDD report. The report recommends agroecology, what many in the United States refer to as organic. And now, what does this mean? This means that Bill Gates, who has long advocated toxic chemotherapy drugs for poor people in Africa who are suffering from the traditional disease of Africa, has actually been responsible for the unintended death and suffering of tens of millions of Africans. He and Bill Clinton, the foundations. Now he's supporting biotechnology. And if he looked at the reports online, I have 37 articles on my website on the dangers of genetically engineered food, we would see that how does one man who is the wealthiest man in the world, come around to where whatever he chooses to do, he has millions of people, scientists, politicians, and professionals, all lining up to say, whatever you want to do, Bill, you must be the smartest guy in the block because you're the wealthiest guy in the block and he's the most powerful guy in the block. And so we'll just go along with it without ever looking at a counterbalancing point of view and its impact upon the world. Now, look at that from the military conquest. Look at our position in Afghanistan and other places in the world like Iraq. Look at all this going on in the world, and it's all the same mindset. Very powerful, very elite, very wealthy individuals who are accountable to no one, who have legions of yes people and everyone lining up to support them. And then you turn around and you talk with an individual and say, you're stressed. Well, why don't we do something about your stress? Why don't we take you into this place of meditation? And you bring them out of that state of meditation in a good way, and suddenly they're facing a world where you're saying, relax, release, relinquish, and rejoin, your four steps to that, the Buddhist formula for cutting through self-deception with the equation of relax and release and relinquish and rejoin. And all the other people, the powerful people and powerful corporations, government-led agencies, are saying just the opposite. You will do what we want, eat what we tell you to eat, drink the water that we sell you, use the electricity we sell you, farm the way we tell you, make clothes in the way we tell you, and at the end of that, if you happen to be stressed, we'll take a tranquilizer or do something else. Your thoughts?
Well, there's two things that hit me very strongly in your commentary. One is that we're very dependent culture. That is, self-doubt sort of rules the day for us. We're not very self-reliant, and I think that culturally we have evolved in that way. When you have thousands of commercials coming at you in a course of a day and a week that say that there's something wrong with you unless you buy this thing, the message that's inherent and sustains itself in the long run is that there's something wrong with me because I didn't buy it. And we're unable to buy everything that is advertised, so we're left feeling that there is something wrong inside of ourselves. When there's something wrong, or when our root issue within ourselves is that there's something wrong with me, then there will be a leaning towards authority or a leaning towards one or something which can tell us how to act, how to be, what to do, what to say. And I find this culture, especially in the tradition I'm working in the spiritual tradition, is very dependent upon that very authority. And what we ask in the spiritual journey is to come to one's own authority, to let one's own sense of seeing and observation and realization be the guideline, be the standard for how one moves and operates in the world. So that's the first point that I think. The second one is the dependency of the culture on comfort. And I think this is a tragedy in the Western world as we now know it, because we have been able to monopolize the percentage of resources in our favor. And we've built the military might sufficient to defend that percentage. So if we see or sense that that percentage is slipping, we'll then move into countries and force that oil supply to continue or whatever it might be. And this dependency on comfort can't be sustained given the climate crisis. And I think what's happening, or what we're starting to perceive now, is that we intuit that we're going to have to give up some of our comfort level in order to sustain the climate in the world as we have known it to be. And this scares us, and it sends us back into a strict sense of denial and protectionism in ourselves, in which we're defending and striking out against the opposite, the truth of the situation. And so I see the arising of a very entrenched population, conservative entrenched population, that's fighting the knowledge of having to give up the comfort that they have thought of as their birthright. So all of the forces are now very acute in our system. This sense of comfort, this sense of dependency, the need for comfort, and the lack of self-reliance. And I think it's leading to some of the crises that you were just pointing out.
I would agree very much. Thank you very much. I appreciate you being on today and sharing your insights. And if people want more information, Stepping Out of Self-Deception, Shambhala Press, and the website is seattleinsight.org. Thank you, Rodney Smith.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound, a buck, or a pound, a buck, or a pound is all that makes the world go around. The clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money. If you happen to be rich and you feel like a nice entertainment, you can pay for a gay escapade. If you happen to be rich and alone and you need a companion, you can ring for the mate. If you happen to be rich and you find you are left by your lover and you moan and you groan quite a lot, you can take it on the chin, call a cab and begin to recover on your 14 car at the yacht. Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes us go around, of that we both are sure. And being poor. Money, 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 money.
Nice to have you with us today, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. Not in studio, I'm back on the road. But joining me from the studio in New York is our executive producer, Richard Gale. And we're going to continue where we left off yesterday. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Gary. Nice to be on again with you. Some of these rare moments. Gary, wanted to follow up and continue with our stimulus plan and some other issues as we build on this and begin to put it into a presentable form. So we'd like to get your commentary again on some additional issues. One is the question of foreclosures. In 2009, there was 2.8 million foreclosures. Estimates for the end of this year, 2010, they're going to be well over 3 million. And that doesn't take into account the additional millions who are already in great debt, are about to lose their homes, and it's just a matter of time. And recently we've seen where Tim Geithner's Home Affordability Modification Program, which HAMP, which by the Treasury's own admission, the program is specifically designed to just target the banks to improve their solvency and utterly ignores the assisting of in any considerable manner the solvency of American homeowners. So consequently, the banks are not required to join the program, but only voluntarily, and the program only reduces homeowners' monthly payments modestly, and it fails to take into account the depreciation of homes as a result of the bank's screw up with the casino gambling of derivatives. So, and moreover, the program itself is utterly bureaucratic. And very few homeowners are actually approved in the process. For example, it was just reported that Chase Bank alone, only 4% of the applicants were approved. So it's really a program that this is the model, the paradigm now that is in place from the Obama administration, and is certainly not going to solve the matter, and we're only going to see more foreclosures, I believe. So your thoughts on that?
Okay. Let's pull back the picture so that we can put it in proper context. What are we talking about? We're talking about people who choose to be gainfully employed, but right now, a majority of the American public, working public, are what you could call the underappreciated working class, an underpaid working class. Now, it wasn't deficit spending that got us out of the Great Depression. It was rather the private sector of small businesses and our parents' sacrifice for us, meaning they were willing to go without and show us how to sacrifice in order for them to survive. Today, young people simply could not survive. They're incapable. They have zero coping skills. And as a result, a lot of the problem today of being in debt revolves around having to buy things for ourselves to show that we have succeeded at something, or our dream has been recognized, or our children will never want, without looking at, is this sustainable? And be realistic about yourself, and don't look at a bubble, because bubbles never are sustainable. But if you get caught in the euphoria of a particular bubble, whether it's a commercial real estate bubble or a hedge fund bubble or a private equity bubble or a housing bubble, you're no longer thinking and acting in a responsible way. However, from our crisis comes rebirth. I'm not saying that in a religious context. I'm saying it in a very spiritual context, because how little time do we spend focused upon what we're doing that is based upon myth and not sustainable until we get a crisis, until you have a heart attack? You're not going to stop eating the hamburgers. And until you get the stroke, you're not going to stop drinking and being stressed out and yelling. You're not going to do it. If we were, we would have done it. It's that simple. If we really were interested in making proper choices about our health, we'd be healthy. We're not. We've never been sicker, fatter, more heart disease, cancer, depression, arthritis, senility. All these are substantially the result of making inappropriate choices. Now, let's look at what we can do about this. So you're talking about a person looking at the four walls in their living room and saying, well, I still have this room to look at tomorrow, next year. What if my kids are not going to be grown and out of the house before we lose it? Stop thinking that your house is the most important asset you have. It is not. Your understanding the significance of you being a human being is your greatest asset. If you took away everything I possess, you will have taken away nothing that is essential to my well-being, happiness, and health. Nothing. So we stress ourselves and we work in the wrong way to hold on to an asset that in and of itself was commodified and then proselytized as being the highest state of achievement within a person's lifetime. You're a homeowner. That's simply not true. The quality of your relationships, the health and viability of your family as a unit, the significance of your position within your society of contributing, those are what are important, not so much bread, mortar, and brick. So we stop making the house excessively important. I believe that no one should be buying a house now. No one. And stop buying into the dream, because here's what happens. There was a time when unions and small businesses were the majority of employers in the United States, and they gave good working conditions in the majority of the cases. Then along came people who began to realize that they could manipulate a system and get ahead of it, and hence control it. Those were the people I spoke about yesterday, the political class, the professional class that supported the political class and its methods, and finally those who became the elite class, and then from the elite class, the controlling elite class. And with those people, you have something you do not have with the rest of society. You have no moral hazard. Now, what do I mean by having no moral hazard? It means that you can be reckless without repercussions for failing. So we've made the banks, the lending institutions like Goldman Sachs and Bank America and Wells Fargo and all the others, we've made them responsible for nothing. They do not have to take any credit for failing. So when you have no moral hazard, you will do anything. A lot of celebrities self-destruct because they surround themselves with people who believe that they're something more than what they are so that they don't have to take the consequences for drinking drugs or any irresponsible acts. Wrecking a car, if the average person did it, they would be held to a social standard of moral hazards. Not celebrities, not power brokers. Well, the family unit at one time was a center of life. It isn't today. We exported so much of our trade and our manufacturing. It began about 1969 when we began to experience in America freedom without restraints or context, opportunistic about everything in our life. That's what led to landing on the moon, but also led to Woodstock. And those are not one and the same phenomena. We were the self-indulgent, narcissistic, selfish, judgmental generation. My generation was, not my parents, not the greatest generation. And our kids are merely weakened clones from us. They are the lowest rotting fruit on the tree. They're indulged into the pleasure principle. Everything goes, anything goes, and lots of disposable income, ours. So we separated ourselves from our past. Big mistake. We didn't trust people who were not heavy into the marketing of themselves. In effect, we became rebels, but rebels without consciousness. So when we look around today, we're looking at a society that predominantly is sexist, racist, elitist, warmongers, and greedy. And yet, only when this begins to implode in bits and pieces do we come to a point where we begin to examine for the first time in our adult lives no moral restraints and what that means in everything we do. We've morphed into what we hated at one point. The self is all. We are the consummate consumer society. And look at China and India close on our heels. And so when Bill Clinton aligned himself as the political elite with the Wall Street elite, he then became the richest of the political elite and hence the policymaker, the wonk, the go-to person. But he was tutored by Robert Rubin, who was the Secretary of the Treasury, but more powerful than Bill Clinton. He was Clinton's mentor. And he is a industrial elite. He is the policymaker. He was the one who was able to get the Glass-Steagall Act rescinded. He was the one who was able to change the way that corporations do business. And so that's where we're at today. So by looking at how Obama is trying to get us out of the mess we're in, you see he's coming to it with a mindset that he cannot change. He's locked in. He's locked into being a political elite, but not a rich political elite. Mm-hmm. He'll get there. And he is therefore beholden to the most powerful people in the land, those behind the scenes who are not politicians, not in the public eye, but who determine by the industries they own, by the boards that they control, boards of directors they control, whether it's in genetic engineering or whether it's in nuclear and coal and oil, whether it's in shipping, these people have their hands into everything. And they then say to their retainers, the professors and the scientists who they control, you go to the White House, you hold these hearings, and you get us subsidies in this area, in this area, in this area. So here's the irony. The irony of it is that the public is completely, totally misled by both the right and the left. Why? Because one says, put more money into bailing out the consumer. The other says, stop putting money into society and stop spending all this money. Okay, they're both wrong. First, because it's, are you mean stop the military-industrial complex getting $800 billion a year it doesn't need? Are you talking about $350 billion for the farming industry, about $500 billion for the medical-industrial complex, about $300 billion for the energy cartels? Do you mean that $2 trillion? No, we don't mean stop those $2 trillion and socialize subsidies to those special interest groups that are controlled by the powerful, the policy-making elite. No, we're talking about the poor subsistence farmer from Alabama, the mother on welfare in Mississippi. Stop that. So what you see, and then the left raises its ugly head and says, build more bureaucracies. We don't care if they don't function. No one ever pays a care. Spend more money. Just spend money. But what if you spend money inappropriately? What if you just add to redundancy? So now, instead of actually helping do anything right at any level, at any time, everyone is caught up in this delusional state that what they're doing matters and it doesn't. There's no happy outcome. Now, here's what you could do. Here's the proper way to deal with this, and the simple way. And if you think you need to be an economist to figure this out, you do not. With all the home foreclosures, here's what you do. You simply demand to the banks that the banks reduce the mortgage to its current value. So, let's say you bought a house at $200,000, and it went up to $400,000, and then you got some of those extra, you know, cash out now so you can take that vacation and your kids can go to Harvard and you can buy your second set of, you know, shotguns. Now that person has got no cash. They're paying interest and premiums on a house that's now worth $100,000. They're underwater. 51% of all the homes in Arizona are underwater, all the homes. And 38% of all the homes in the United States are underwater. They're never going to get out of that. Because I predicted 6 months ago that in the next 12 months, real estate would drop 12 to 25%. It's now at 25%. And I now predict that in the next 24 months, real estate will drop 50%. 50% in the next 24 months we're at. We're not in a recession. We're in a depression. So what do? You then go to the homeowner and say, okay, you're underwater. You're going to walk away from it, or you're going to borrow money that you shouldn't be spending to us, the banks. Instead, you should be able to spend that within the society and help yourself and help others, or save or pay down your credit card. So we're going to make your new mortgage worth what the current market is. So now you don't owe $400,000. You only owe what the current value of the market is, which is $100,000. Now the cost of all your go down, and you get a fixed 2% interest. Now, 2% is extremely reasonable. It's never been that low except for the GI Bill in 1945, when people coming back from the Second World War could buy get a house built for a GI loan of 2%. Now, 2% is still 200% profit for the banks. Why? Because they're getting their interest at zero from the Fed window. So they're getting zero interest. They've been charging you 8% if you're late, 10, 12%, and it can go way up beyond that. So they've been dealing in massive amounts of liquidity. Now you have a chance to stay in your home. Your home is valued at the real market, and the President of the United States put a 3-year moratorium on any foreclosures. Now when you lose your home, the homes on both sides of you drop in value by up to 25% just by you being out of your house. Then it gets run down, then the whole neighborhood goes down, and now their values go down, even though the value of their property goes down, even though their mortgages don't. So that's one way we could immediately stop all home foreclosures and keep people in their homes. Remember, you said, Richard, that there was 2.5 million foreclosures last year and over 3 million this year, over 5 million foreclosures. You're dealing with 4 people per home. That's 20 million Americans were thrown out on the street.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Let us be very clear who threw them out. The entire Democrat and the entire Republican and the President of the United States just visualize them coming, knocking on your door, saying you've got to leave, and having their SWAT teams and their CIAs and their military industrial agencies and their attack dogs, in case you decide not to, because these people are ruthless. They will do anything to anyone at any time because they know there's no legal consequence because they made sure of it. So understand that we now live in a police state. Oh, did we forget we live in a police state? Let me remind you from something in today's news about living in a police state. Wait, I don't think we're going to have time to do both. No, I won't. I'll hold that. But I want to get to this this whole idea of what the Ninth Circuit Court said about their right to come on your property without warrants and attach devices that can track you on and without any search warrant at all or probable cause at all. In any case, I'll get back to that. Now they've thrown you out. What happens when a person's out? Well, more often than not, you're going to be having your car repossessed. And then how are you going to find work? You're not going to be able to. And then you're going to be a drain and a stress upon everyone else that's trying to help you in your hour of need, especially if you have an extended family. So we stop that. We show we actually are capable, hard as it may be, since we're so capable of causing wars and without any thought of the infliction of pain and suffering upon the people who are the innocent victims in those wars. But now we're intentionally, with malice aforethought, inflicting pain and suffering upon these people. So why don't the average Americans actually get smart enough, they're capable of it, of taking all their money, savings, every single nickel you have in any major bank, take it out and put it into the smaller credit unions and small savings loan institutions. We haven't even done that. And that's just amazing. There is the Stockholm Syndrome in full force. You know, respect and kiss the feet of the person who's over you, beating you with a whip. Or you're too dumb to realize it. I don't think we're that dumb. I think that we're that culpable. Now you stop the foreclosures, and then you stop the repossessions. And then you bring the interest rates down. Now a person has a chance, with what money they do have, to continue life in that environment. Next question.
Thank you, Gary. The second issue we've been seeing is, particularly with the from the 2009 tax returns, corporate tax returns, where we're looking at 25 of the largest multinational American multinational corporations are paid almost no taxes. The best examples would be General Electric, which although it didn't pay any taxes 2009. ExxonMobil paid no taxes to U.S. government, although it paid billions to other countries, but not one cent of that went to Uncle Sam. These are the other countries, you know, where there's like Abu Dhabi, Angola, where they have the subsidies, subsidiaries, the Bahamas, Cayman Islands, Hong Kong, Singapore. And you can pretty much go right down the Forbes lists of top American corporations, and you would see that these major American companies are paying nothing in terms of.
Do you know how much money is parked in offshore accounts by major corporations and individuals, so they don't have to pay tax in the United States? Over $6 trillion. That's with a T, trillion.
Yeah.
Here's what we have to do. We have to completely abolish the entire U.S. tax code. Close down the IRS, and I hope they don't get another job. I want them to actually suffer a little bit. All right? I want to see no Federal Reserve. I want to see no Internal Revenue Service, and we don't need them. But we have to be smarter than what we act. Democrats want more taxes, tax the rich and tax everyone. They're idiots. And the Republicans drop all the taxes, and they're stupid also. Why? Because what is the whole point of taxation? Representation and quality of service that is common to all. For example, public schools, fire, and emergency hospital care, and state medical care. The type of care that we need for all people is what the taxes should go for. However, taxes go for the military-industrial complex. They go for the completely wasteful and completely corrupt healthcare system. So let's do this. One other thing I would do for the healthcare system, I would have no fault medical care. meaning no more malpractice insurance for doctors, nurses, or clinics. You simply have no capacity to sue someone, and we've got to stop all the litigation, unnecessary litigation, which is probably 95% of all litigation, and cap all of this to what the person actually would lose based upon what they had been earning until they're able to get back on their feet. And that would come from a common fund paid for with 1% of the profits and or 1% of the income from all those individuals into a common public trust. Two, and then they would also be able to be helped without the cost to them, so the victim would actually get the help they need, but they're not going to exploit a system. And that would also allow us not to have all those unnecessary medical procedures, which would save us about $200 billion a year and keep a lot of good doctors working that otherwise are now saying it's just too expensive, it's too risky, I don't want to do this anymore, and changing careers. With the taxes, here's how you lower taxes substantially and get more for the dollar. A, you make every single American responsible for paying some taxes. I don't believe anybody should not pay some taxes. Even if it's a percentage, pay some taxes to show that you care about all that is being done for you. And it should be on across the board basis. So this way, no human being can use any tax lawyers or CPAs to get up paying the same percentage. Let's just say arbitrarily for this moment, our argument's sake, we say at an income level, everyone pays a federal income tax of 12%. Now, that means we then have to pare back unnecessary bureaucracies and make government work within the budget with citizen insight. Then the state level, we have massive corruption at every state. In fact, the corruption is so bad in Albany and in Trenton, you actually have to have some form of gas mask to drive into the city. You just die from the stench of the decrepit politicians. And everyone knows it. And all the insider dealings and contracts, so you give them a budget. You say, this is your budget. You've got now 5% at the state level. So now the states have 5% to work in. And then from there, you get the local government and you give them 3%. Let them work with it. And this way, you make things work within the budget. Then, if every corporation, no matter how large or how small, had to pay a corporate tax that would be divided into a pool to go for federal, state, and county and city additional spending on infrastructure, and if that corporate tax, let's say, were a reasonable corporate tax, like 10%, well, right now it can go much higher than that, but 10% with no one able to deduct anything. That's it. It's 10% across the board. You've just raised the amount of income from what I just mentioned to put into social structures, into our federal, state, and local governments, almost double what they now have. So you're actually giving them more money because everyone's paying and every corporation's paying. Not the ones you were just mentioning and thousands of others don't pay a nickel, but their trillions of dollars go offshore. This way, it doesn't burden the person. Then you're not dealing with in New York State. In New York State, you're going to pay 55-60% when you add all things, all the different taxes in. And if you own a small business, you're going to pay more because you're also paying real estate taxes. So this way, you're saving about half the taxes you'd be paying. So our taxes go down as a society, giving us more disposable income, and yet we make our government accountable on all levels with these flat taxes and get rid of the IRS, get rid of all the tax codes, get rid of inheritance taxes and school taxes and property taxes, get rid of all of it because you don't need it. Because if you don't look at the larger picture, then we're being taxed to death and we can't take it anymore. And we're not getting anything for our money. We're getting no-bid contracts. We're getting massive bureaucracies. We're getting indifference. We're getting these people who work within these bureaucracies who feel that, well, I work under this, you know, this set of laws, and you can't fire me, no matter how bad, ugly, angry, or indifferent I am. That's what we have to do. That would change America at all levels. We're going to say goodbye to our WMYE audience, but we're going to continue for another hour with a very important interview coming up from the Himalayas. I'm Gary Knoll. Go to GaryKnoll.com or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com to continue listening to our program. Now, I've done the math on the tax business. I've done the math on how many corporations don't pay any taxes and how many individuals don't pay taxes and how many pay a whole lot of taxes and how many people pay no taxes. And everybody plays the system in any way they can. And I believe we've got to stop playing the system. I believe everybody has to pay something. Everybody. No exceptions. And this way, you base it upon a percentage so that everybody contributes something and in a fair way. And that way you don't see someone who makes $100 million figuring out ways through their tax shelters and offshore accounts not to pay money on that, and corporations not paying money. And I also believe that we should start buying America. If you go buy Walmart, you're a fool. If you go buy to Sam's Club and Costco and Lowe's and these other places, stop it. Get off the grid. If you really care about America, then support America. And support Americans and their jobs here. Buy your food organically and locally grown. Don't buy it in the big Whole Foods. That's just a nonsense organization. Buying their stuff from China and calling it organic. What a nonsense. In any case, next question.
Okay, Gary. Actually, just going back on the one tax thing, do you see, it's just a kind of hypothetical question, but with the Supreme Court ruling with the Citizens United, the personhood of corporations, does that change the taxing of corporations at all?
No, it doesn't. It gives them the right to contribute money to campaigns, and here's another thing. America should have been outraged in the extreme of this. And have demonstrated against the Supreme Court, a group of fools dressed up in the most pretentious manner as if they actually have brains. They don't. They're all culpable, capable, and I feel utterly corrupt in their contempt for the American consumer. When you make a corporation, giving them the same rights as an individual, you've just completely knocked the legs out of any pretense that our democracy exists. It does not. We are just one gigantic autocracy with those who have the power to buy the votes, which is easy to do, and that's what they're doing. Next issue.
Okay, Gary, we only have several more minutes. Perhaps if you would like, and then our guest from the Tibetan Prime Minister will be on.
I also believe that what we should do with credit cards is immediately stop this. This is worse than Tony Soprano. We should give credit card companies, which are banks, the same banks we bailed out, we should cap all their interest rates at 4%.
Mm-hmm.
That gives them 400% margin of profit. We should forgive all penalties and late fees, and also on student loans, all penalties and late fees, bring the interest down to 4%. And that way people could begin to save some money. And otherwise, it's just a completely usurious system.
It is. I agree. Okay. Closing remark, and then we'll jump over to our guest.
Okay. Well, we still have a few moments.
Okay.
We have eight minutes.
Yeah. The last question was concerning the credit card debt, because it's well over $1 trillion now of outstanding revolving debt, which basically means the including credit card debt to commercial banks, credit unions, the finance companies.
Yeah, and it's pure profit to the credit card companies, which are the banks, the same banks that we gave billions to and took their bad debts through the Federal Reserve window, and we cleaned their bad debts and gave them good currency in return. It was a form of legal money laundering.
And then there's still the continuation of penalizing. There was a National Consumer Protection report showing that a third of all Americans, this is just during the meltdown period, but a third of all American consumers have now been penalized.
And who's penalizing you? The bankers are penalizing you because they have the power, and they know that when they own Chris Dodd and they own Barney Frank and they own all those other clowns on these committees, they can get away with it. All right, they're the ones who were able to go to the White House and sit in on conferences on the Wall Street bailout. And I also believe, as far as Wall Street goes, let all of the people on Wall Street, let them all either cap cap the ability of them, stop the ability of them to trade in commodities essential to life. That's crucial. That would make an enormous difference in helping us. And also, we should bring it back to the no bank, no lending institution can gamble on derivatives unless it actually has the assets to support the gamble it's taking. Right now, it doesn't have to have that. And banks can loan any amount they want against what they have in reserve. They should not be able to have more than an 8-to-1 reserve. They can loan $8 for everyone they have in reserve. More than that, once again, you're giving banks the right to print money and make risky bets, and they don't have to be responsible if they miss on the bets.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to share this because it's going back to the taxes of citizens pay, and because we're in this mode of myth busting, and we constantly hear how Americans don't pay near the taxes of what Europeans do. But this is from Scott Hodge, president of a nonprofit tax foundation, does some of the more cutting edge statistical analysis on taxes. And according to him, that when you add in all of the taxes, the state, the local, the U.S. now has the highest tax burden among industrialized countries. So,
and they want to add in a value added tax of 20%, and they want to increase the state sales taxes by another 2%. So when you add up the total state taxes, the sales taxes, the value-added taxes, the federal income tax, the workman's compensation taxes, and if you're an employer, you're paying all those taxes that that you have with an employee, you're up to 65%.
Which is much higher than any European country.
That's correct, and we're not even giving people in this country what other European countries have historically given them.
Exactly.
So, and Americans have got to realize that you can't just cut taxes the way they're suggesting, and you can't raise taxes the way they're suggesting. Those are macro irresponsible programs. You have to look carefully at what is the object that you want to do. Make government responsible by making it smaller and make it actually work for people and get rid of all the profiteering. As long as we have legislators who can give billions of dollars collectively to their hometowns and whatever they do to bring back the bacon, they say, then you're going to have a corrupt system. And we've got to stop that as well. Zero on these entitlements to politicians to get reelected. And I believe we should have, in elections, I believe that one of the ways you stop this is have one term only, 4 years, for any person elected to any office and they can't run again. I also believe that in a process, all elections should be publicly supported with not a single penny being allowed to be given by foundations, individuals, or corporations. Have everyone write out what their policies are, their programs are, what they're for or against, and then submit that so you can go online and read what a person's for or against. And then from that, you have a series of debates where everyone is included. And then the public has a right to make two votes. The first is to vote from the larger group to the smaller group, and again, no one is excluded from being able to participate. And then from that, you have a lottery, and then you get down to your final candidates, and then you have the whole process take 3 months so we don't drain our system and we don't allow people to buy themselves an office and then use all the time they're in office to bring in the lobbyists with the special interest groups to keep themselves in power. It's a stupid system. It's utterly corrupt. And that's how one day you end up losing your home and saying, why is my house being foreclosed and I'm being thrown out when the bank that I'm paying this money to is throwing me out? They weren't thrown out. They were bailed out. So how does Chase Manhattan, how does Citicorp, how does Bank America keep themselves solvent when they should have been closed down and their doors closed and my door is now closed because... And then you start to realize, and someone has to step up and say, because everyone is corrupt. The people, the talking heads, they don't live in your house or poverty. And they don't have to worry about trying to subsist on the take-home pay you make. They are there to talk about some form of utopian way of dealing with the problem and blaming the opposite political party for it, and not themselves. The legislators are all fully aware that we could have a moratorium on home foreclosures, but they don't want to risk alienating those people who, not just in the current political system, but those who are going to be profiting them when they leave it. Remember, the idea of being a politician is not what you do when you're in office. It's how much you can capitalize that in office for when you leave office, and that is a lot of money.
Okay, thank you, Gary.
Okay.
We'll have a lot more to speak.
Yeah, a lot more. This is a continuing our form of a stimulus program. We started yesterday putting people to work. Today I dealt with ways we can drop our taxes, make government smaller but more responsible, and get rid of the credit card debt, and keep people in their homes, and buy America, and don't trust the politicians, and get rid of the agencies that are corrupt and are of no value to us. Again, these may seem impossible, but we have to start somewhere with ideas that go against the grain, that are really practical, and it is the simple answer in this case that actually works. It is the confusion and complication of the political system that creates this impossible change. We believe in possibility, but the possibility will only come after crisis, and we are about to enter some really crisis times. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that heartbreak hotel where I'll be. I'll be just a lonely baby. Well, I'm so lonely. I'll be just so lonely. I could die. Although it's always crowded, you still can find.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Null. In just one moment, we're going to be in an interview with the Prime Minister of the Tibetan government in exile in the Himalayas. Actually in part of India, but it's up against and into the Himalayas. Please understand, this is probably the gentleman considered the greatest intellect within Buddhism, second most powerful one within the Tibetan community to the Dalai Lama, and rarely gives an interview. This is an extremely rare interview. So, but I also have to let you know that we have a very poor technical connection. It can't be corrected because of the difficulty of beaming out where he is located. Secondly, I realize that some of what he says you simply won't be able to understand or hear clearly. However, I will reinterpret in easy-to-understand lay language what he is saying. It's just one of those historic interviews that if it were done in a studio here in the United States or in a studio in India, good. But we have to get it where we can. That said, let's now go to our interview.